Hello, my name is collaterally Marcus Freestone. Hope you enjoyed the new theme tune. Well, it's episode 10, so why not? I thought we'd have a theme tune. After three episodes about consciousness, I want to move on to more practical matters. For those new listeners, I'll briefly set out the mission statement of this podcast. My aim with this podcast and the book is to cut a swathe through all the metaphysical hippie nonsense, the pseudoscience and misappropriation of quantum theory, and the Freudian self-help industry. My belief is that an understanding of how the brain actually works and how we interact with other people is what we need to sort out problems of anxiety and depression. I have had both of these for most of my life and am convinced that they are psychological and existential in nature rather than being a medical condition. Not that I'm discouraging people from seeking medical help. I know many people who've had their problems greatly ameliorated by medication, but it doesn't work for everyone, and it certainly didn't for me. You may be able to relieve certain symptoms, but you can't change a person's worldview with a tablet. And that's what I believe governs our state of happiness or unhappiness, our perception of the world, ourselves, and other people. Before we crack on, the website for this podcast is marcusfreestone.com. You can also find links to my novels, music, my comedy podcast, and the free ebook and not free paperback that accompany this podcast. I've also just started a Facebook page where I'll be posting videos and links to various relevant things. There's also a Google Plus page. If you could join them and interact, post links, start discussions, then we can hopefully build a community, and eventually I might be able to get some sponsorship or donations that would allow me to devote more time to this podcast. I'd love to do one every week, travel around and interview people, but I just can't afford it at the present. Anyway, on that positive aspiration for the future, let's get into this week's subject, which is social interaction. We all have our own view of ourselves, our skills and discrepancies, our achievements and failures, and our place within local subgroups of society and the world at large. This view of ourselves is based on many factors and is rarely accurate. I sometimes hubristically view myself as better than the idiots I'm surrounded by. Other times I view myself as an awful, horrible person whom the world would be better off without. Neither of these polar extreme views is true, of course, and intellectually I know this, even in the moment I'm cognitively experiencing the viewpoints. However, because of the emotional history and triggers associated with aspects of these ideas, I feel them to be true in the moment. Then, of course, there is the view other people have of us and us of them. These are usually equally inaccurate and fallacious. It has been demonstrated in many social and psychological studies that precedent is a huge factor in human thought and behaviour. Once we have established a pattern of thinking or behaving in a certain manner in a given situation or towards a specific person or group of people, then those thoughts and behaviours will continue unchallenged unless a change is forced by external factors or by a deliberate, conscious change from within. We are extremely lazy and reluctant when it comes to changing our minds about anything, because the brain has evolved to crave predictability and certainty above chaos. Therefore, once we have met someone and judged them, assessed and pigeonholed them by our own criteria, we will be unlikely to change our stance. That's why first impressions are indeed so important. When you also factor in confirmation bias, the hugely powerful phenomena whereby we dismiss evidence that disagrees with our beliefs and over-amplify, even fabricate, evidence that supports our beliefs, we can see that the whole area of social interaction is deeply skewed and prejudiced. Another element is what I call the levels of translation that occur in human communication. This is a little theory I came up with myself, because your innermost thoughts in the most primitive part of your brain are not expressed in language, because language didn't exist when those parts of the brain evolved. So your innermost thoughts are visceral, emotional, primeval. They're not expressed linguistically. You then translate those primeval feelings into thoughts that you can think about in your own head. So that's one level of translation. You then, at the second level, translate those into spoken language that you convey to another person. But we know that words mean different things to different people. So the person you are talking to will translate your words into their own interpretation of language and meaning. So that's another level of translation. They will then take that down into their own internal monologue and think about what you said, and that will in turn then be translated again into their own primeval language-free part of the primitive brain. So there's all these levels of translation going on during even the simplest of human communication. And there's also the fact that language changes, and there are colloquialisms, and there's lots of technical words, and Google is now in the Oxford English Dictionary as a verb and all that, yes, but language is still relatively unsophisticated. We certainly have problems in describing the functions of the universe or the functions of the human brain in mere language, because language evolved for look out, there's a woolly mammoth, run, or look at that thing there, let's kill it and eat it. That's what language evolved for. And as I keep saying, our brains haven't evolved in the last 40,000 years. So modern technology has outpaced us, and we can't really cognitively keep up with it. So when we're interacting with other people, there are many factors to take into account. There is also the problem of individual difference and group homogeny. This is the well-established and observed social phenomena whereby people believe that members of the group to which they perceive themselves to belong are all individuals, but they see people who belong to different groups as all the same, all homogeneous. So this, of course, will greatly affect and prejudice how you will judge other people. If someone is perceived to be of the same race, the same social class, or however you judge people, if someone is perceived to belong to the same group as you, then you will judge them as being an individual. You will judge them more kindly than a group to which you don't belong, a group you're not a part of, a group of these others. You will judge them as, oh well, I've seen or heard something about those sort of people, those people are like that, those people behave in that way, therefore that person is one of them, so they must be like that because they're all the same. And this simple psychological phenomena is obviously at the roots of all prejudice. Something I've struggled with throughout my life is body language, especially eye contact. Perhaps I'm somewhere on the low end of the autistic spectrum, perhaps it's some other manner of social deficiency, but I've always found eye contact physically painful. I'm aware that I often, during a conversation, am looking frantically around the room or at the floor, anywhere but at the person's eyes. I'm all too aware that this makes me appear rude or shifty, but I simply can't help it. From the earliest age I can remember, I've always found eye contact painful, in the same way as walking from a darkened room into blazing sunshine is painful. I hate anyone in the street even glancing in my direction and do my utmost to minimise my time in public. I prefer to go out late at night when there's nobody around. Paradoxically, I'm perfectly happy standing in front of an audience. Indeed, I'm often more comfortable there than in everyday life. I think this is because in those situations, I am prepared and have a plan for what I'm going to say. Whether it was doing stand-up comedy many years ago or the teaching I do now, I somehow feel more of a real person, whatever that means, in front of an audience than I do during any other type of social interaction. I don't like large social groups, but I'm more comfortable with an audience than any one-to-one social situation. I think it's because an audience are an amorphous, impersonal mass and are therefore somewhat depersonalised and less intimidating. If you are confident and know what you want to say, an audience will tend not to interrupt, even at a stand-up gig, where the lighting is often such that you can't see them anyway. In front of an audience, whether it's a physical audience in the room or an audience at a distance, such as someone reading one of my books, or you, yes, you there, and stop doing that, you at this moment listening to this podcast, put that away, that's disgusting. I feel self-confident and in control because this is something I'm choosing to do, and I feel that I know what I'm talking about. When I'm walking down the street, I'm not in control of my environment, I am not prepared, I do not feel self-confident, and I am not choosing to have those social interactions. If a stranger speaks to me, I immediately experience panic, even if they are just asking me the time or simple directions, because now I am in unknown territory and am not in control. Often, especially if I have headphones on, I will pretend not to have heard somebody and do my best to avoid the interaction. I know that nothing bad is going to happen, but I feel the panic and desire to avoid the situation nonetheless. Like all behaviour patterns, our social skills are formed in early childhood. I was an only child with no father, so I naturally became very introverted. I even disliked other children. Instead of wanting to be social and break out of my isolation, I retreated further into myself. I learned to be self-sufficient, and to this day all my hobbies are solitary ones, writing, reading, music, etc. Conversely, I have met people who are so reliant on the company of others that even 10 minutes on their own is unbearable. They become anxious and crave any form of human contact because they have no inner resources to sustain them. I believe this is at the root of much of the current obsession with technology and social media. Many people define themselves entirely by how many people read their social media posts or how many texts or phone calls they receive in an evening. They see any period that doesn't involve non-stop communication as a negation of their self. So what is the positive attitude we should be taking towards social interaction? As always, it's all about a sense of perspective. When somebody glances at you in the street, they probably haven't even consciously registered your presence. Most of the time, we're living on autopilot, governed by our subconscious robot. Even if they have noticed you, the chances of them judging you are minuscule. Everyone else is as wrapped up in their own concerns, anxieties, and problems as you are, and they simply don't have time to critique the hundreds of people who flicker momentarily through their periphery every single day. And even if that person is forming a negative or derogatory judgment about you, it will be based on an instantaneous prejudice. Something about you will have triggered one of their own biases, and they will be associating you, based on no evidence whatsoever, with a type of person they dislike. In these circumstances, it really is not about you. It's a reflection of them, and it's not your problem. Think back to yesterday. Can you remember every single person you encountered during the day? What about last week or last month? Do you constantly think about everyone you've ever walked past in the street? Of course you don't, so why would they be thinking about you? It's been demonstrated that the human brain is capable of holding about 150 genuine relationships at once. Beyond that, pretty much everyone you encounter is instantly forgotten. So, what is there to be anxious about? I was bullied a lot in school because I was fat, shy, awkward, and had eczema. I was the most obvious target in junior school. Strangely, I was mostly picked on by friends for some reason. To any young people listening who may be in a similar situation now, I'm delighted to tell you as a 43-year-old that, no matter what the stresses of adult life may be, all that crap from school just vanishes. As an adult, nobody cares if you have the latest brand of trainers, the wrong haircut, or listen to unfashionable music. The best thing about being an adult is that you can be whoever you like and nobody cares. In fact, unlike childhood, being different is a positive asset in adult life. All the people who invented the modern world, the technological innovators, do you think they were cool and popular at school? No, of course they weren't. People who are innovative and creative in adult life tend to not have been in the popular set in school, almost without exception. And these days, young people have outlets I never had. You can make your own music, films, and have your own website. I had a typewriter. Mostly in social interactions, we reap what we sow. If you go out into the world expecting people to ignore you or be hostile, then not only will you behave in such a way as to provoke these responses, you will also perceive those responses when they are not there. I have done this myself countless times when in a depressed mood. Somebody invites me into a conversation and I think, I'm worthless. Nobody is interested in anything I have to say. They're just being polite. They won't understand me. They'll take it the wrong way, etc. And then I'll either say nothing, walk away, or say something weird or aggressive to provoke the rejection that I know is coming anyway. Despite all the negative and trendy pessimism in the media, most people are okay. If you are decent to them, they'll be decent to you. However, the nicest of people will not want to spend time with you if you practice something I am often all too guilty of, alienation. I often alienate people by constantly giving a negative, self-defeating account of myself. When meeting new people, before I realise what I'm doing, I'm listing all the negative things about myself, the things that have gone wrong in my life, and the things I hate about the world and other people. On a good day, I will enthuse about my passions and achievements and find positive things in common with other people. On a bad day, I alienate myself from them before they've had a chance to discover anything positive about me. I also often find that, even when I'm saying something I consider positive, my tone of voice and body language is such that people perceive me as negative. Other people can alienate us with their attitude, but more often we alienate ourselves with our attitude. It makes such a huge difference to show a positive front to the world, even if you're not feeling like that inside. We can't choose the events that happen to us in life. We can't even entirely choose the emotions to which we are subjected. But we can choose the attitude we take towards them. If you're in a negative frame of mind, you can choose to stay there, or choose to attempt to get out of it. If something bad happens, you can choose to try to put it behind you, or you can choose to dwell on it and let it take over your life. Nobody leads a charmed life. Everyone has good and bad things happen to them. However, it is up to us to make the choice to fully accept and enjoy the good rather than worrying about how soon it will be over, and also to choose to adopt a stoical and balanced approach towards the bad rather than adopting the fatalistic attitude that one or two bad things mean that our life is permanently ruined. The opposite of social interaction is, of course, isolation. If alienating people isn't enough, you can avoid them altogether. This is a bad idea for many reasons, and I speak as someone who knows from experience. In my 30s, I had an extended period of isolation. It was partly enforced by illness, but I still let it get out of hand. I didn't meet a single new person for about 6 years, and, apart from going out to buy food, would go weeks at a time without leaving the house. I began to collapse in on myself, and years passed without anything of significance happening in my life. The toll on my physical and mental health was enormous. At one point, there were only two people I would ever have any kind of conversation or meaningful contact with, and those incidents would often be weeks apart. Eventually, I knew this couldn't continue, so I signed up for several evening courses and went out and made new friends. It turned my life around and woke me up to how I had been living. I still live alone and almost certainly always will, but I will never go back to that state of hermitude again. Hiding from the world solves nothing. It makes everything worse. Your problems or perceived problems don't go away. They amplify and fester as you sit alone and brood upon them. You may be avoiding negative stimuli, but you'll also be avoiding any positive stimuli, such as emotional support from friends, not to mention the vital mental health benefits of getting out and about and promoting endorphins through exercise and serotonin production by direct sunlight. If you're lucky enough to live somewhere where you can see the sun, I live in Wales. Protracted time alone will turn your mind inwards and distort your perspective on the world and your place within it. So, that concludes episode 10. We're finally into double figures. In the next episode, which I'm thinking of controversially calling episode 11, we'll delve further into the minefield of social interactions. As ever, any suggestions are more than welcome. Email me or leave a message or post via the Facebook or Google Plus page. This has been a Me Sitting on My Sofa Productions for the interwebs. I made this!